Hello and welcome to Science Weekly. I'm Alok Char. This week, synthetic biologist Paul Fremont on why the future lies with organic machines. We'll talk technology and ethics. On the 40th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing, we speak to the man responsible for getting NASA back to the moon and perhaps further to Mars. All that, plus biofuels from algae, the rise of swine flu, and a radical plan to cut the UK's carbon habits. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11. Tower cleared.
Here, we got a roll program.
Welcome to the show, everyone, and as you might have heard, we actually do have a round of people applauding and clapping whenever we start this podcast. Our panellist this week is James Randerson. James, just away from the space theme here, let me ask you a hypothetical question. If you had a lab in front of you and you could make any sort of organism to do anything you like, what would it be? What would it do?
I'd like to make a bacterium that can do the washing up and change nappies.
Well, actually, fortunately for you, James, our guest might be able to help. Paul Fremont is a professor of protein crystallography and co-director of the Centre for Synthetic Biology and Innovation at Imperial College London. Now, synthetic biology is something we've touched on before in this podcast, but we thought we'd tackle it head on today. It's an emerging field that combines engineering with biology. At Imperial College, Paul's developing ways to make organisms that could be useful for harnessing energy, to make sensors, and even new materials. Paul, welcome to Science Weekly.
Thanks very much.
Let's just jump in, shall we, with what synthetic biology is. We're going to come to whether you can make James's washing up thing later. But tell us, in your own words, what synthetic biology is.
In my words, synthetic biology is the application of engineering principles to redesign or re-engineer biological systems to make potentially new organisms, to make biological-based devices, to make little manufacturing microbes that would be able to do things that we want them to do, but in a controllable and more predictable way, as opposed to just sort of tweaking around with the organism and hoping that it'll do what you want it to do.
So a lot of people talk about biological spare parts in the way that you can pick up a catalogue of electronic spare parts now, resistors, transistors, all this stuff, and build whatever you like out of them with silicon chips. Is that where you're going with this?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the driving principles. I think that's it's an important principle because it would allow the field to develop into a very robust engineering, potentially engineering discipline to allow us to do lots of applications, lots of important applications. So I think the modularity, the robustness, the reliability, the predictability, all of those sort of things I think are really important in synthetic biology. And of course, biologists find that very difficult because biological systems are inherently unpredictable sometimes. There's sort of they have evolutionary systems, as our colleague across the road probably knows, which allows them to evolve and adapt to their local environments very effectively. And so therefore, what we're trying to do is manipulate genetic circuits, put new genetic circuits into those organisms in the hope that we can control and predict what the outcomes from those circuits would be.
Given the complexity of these biological systems, as you said, and the uncertainty with which they behave, I mean, it's surely a mammoth task to try and constrain all of that. Why not just use electronics and make electronics better? What's biology got that electronics will never get to?
Well, I mean, okay, so biology is essentially chemistry. So if we're talking about manufacturing processes, we have many chemistry manufacturing processes to make drugs and other types of chemicals that we need for everyday life. Well, if we can adapt biological systems to produce those chemicals or drugs or other types of useful molecules, that's an incredibly efficient way to do it. And sometimes the chemistry that we can do in a test tube is so complex that you can only reach a certain level, whereas in biological systems, they can actually do incredibly complex chemistry and create incredibly complex molecules that we can't necessarily do in a test tube.
So give us some examples. What kinds of things can we expect?
The classic one that everyone's talked about recently is the J. Kiesling artemisinin, which is the anti-malaria drug, which I think is a really nice example. It's a very complicated chemical entity, almost impossible to synthesize in a test tube. And what he's done is he's engineered yeast and bacteria to make this molecule very efficiently and robustly so that, you know, actually it's going to be put into sort of a manufacturing process to produce this very cheaply and effectively.
And, I mean, in future, you're thinking that this could go into all sorts of areas which are not medicine even. We're talking, as we've mentioned in the intro, energy, for example, or materials. What are some of those things?
Yeah, well, the energy, I think, is really important. And I think it's fantastically important application and driver at this particular time, given the problems we face with energy. And the idea here is to use biological systems to create new fuels. And of course, we've been doing that for some time. We've been making essentially ethanol or bioethanol for some time using sugarcane and other types of harvested material, biomass materials. But of course, we want to actually make this much more efficient. We want to do it to make new types of biofuels. And of course, this is a big driver. That's one aspect. And of course, the algae story this week was interesting about, you know, kind of harnessing algae to make biofuels. I think that's a really interesting idea because then you're taking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere.
The algae was, of course, our friend Craig Venter. We'll come to him later in the show. But James?
Just to pick up the sort of engineering analogy, I mean, at the moment there's this rush to produce various kind of slottable parts, if you like, into synthetic biology organisms, if you like, and so things like switches, etc. And this is obviously very similar to electronics, that you have a set of spare parts that you can put into different circuits in different orders, and those circuits do different things. Given that that's sort of the route we're going down, or seems to be, where are we? Where's the sort of analogy for where we were with electronics? I mean, what sort of year are we at in terms of the computer?
1950s? No, but it could easily be transistors that are very unreliable, very noisy. An engineer spent many years trying to get all that noise down. Engineers can't stand noise. And, of course, they find biological systems incredibly frustrating because they're incredibly noisy. And so I think we're at the point in very early era of electronic components when they were trying to build them reliable, robustly, and all the rest of it.
Do we need a sort of world war to get us over that hump, you know, with the sort of Enigma machine decoders
I don't think so. I think what we need is serious investment, to be truthful, to bring this field up to a level where it can really deliver what the promise is. So it's promising a lot at the moment, but actually there's a lot of science to be done to allow that promise to be realized. And I think, you know, the only way we're going to get there is by, you know, serious investment, both at academia and in industry.
Do you think it'll take us, you know, 50-odd years to get, or 60 years to get from the where electronics was in the 50s to where we are today with computers?
I don't think so, because if you think about in the early 70s, we started learning how to clone DNA. And, you know, we've now got the full genome sequences for, you know, most major organisms on the planet. And that's a very short period of time, I think. So, you know.
Just on a totally different subject, I suppose, or a different aspect to this subject. Some people are quite worried about the sort of safety implications of this, that either on purpose or by accident, people could create organisms that would be rather dangerous. Maybe they'd take some hints from things like, you know, previous pandemic flus or smallpox or, you know, whatever it might be, or maybe just devise something very nasty themselves. With all knowledge, there comes potential dangers, but are there special dangers here that need to be specially regulated?
I mean, there are issues I think are really important to discuss and open a debate on, because we're talking about biological systems, we're talking about manipulation of biological systems on a scale perhaps that we haven't done it to this point. So clearly, you know, we need to have this open debate. We need to think about what are the costs, benefits, what are the risks, all that sort of stuff. In terms of regulation, I mean, most, you know, molecular biology, as you know, in the world and in the UK, you know, is highly regulated. You can't go and, you know, clone a gene and, you know, re-engineer an organism. You know, you can't just do that in your back garden shed or whatever. So we're all under very strict regulation already. And I suspect what will happen is that this regulation will evolve to take into account synthetic biology organisms, to take into account some of the risks analyses that we'll need to do on these organisms.
Paul, the Royal Academy of Engineering recently had a meeting, which you were at, where you discussed some of this stuff about the potential issues. I mean, I don't want to linger on this too much because, you know, there are lots of exciting things to talk about too, but you presented a report there which looked at public attitudes to this stuff. What were the results of that, and did they surprise you?
Really surprising. It was an interesting exercise for me personally, because I hadn't actually done this public engagement, and I expected, I probably shouldn't say this, but I expected the public to actually not really get to grips with it. But I was really surprised that the people that I met anyway, they really began to formulate very good ideas about what this field meant. And they kind of weighed up the costs, the benefits, and the risks. And they came out thinking, you know, that actually in certain situations, this is fantastic. And they were really excited by it. And when I said to them, well, you know, what about new, if we make new microbe organisms, they said, well, it's better than killing, you know, killing them. So it was a sort of interesting argument. As soon as you went up the evolutionary tree and you started talking about, you know, maybe sort of eukaryotes or humans or something, then there was a complete, absolutely no way were they interested in that. Whereas microorganisms, they some of them actually didn't think they were alive. We want to hear what the public think about the technology, actually. What we do want to end up is in this GM debate, which was very debilitating and actually very tedious, actually.
All right, Paul, well, let's leave that there for now. We'll come back to you towards the end of the show as well. Let's move on to this week's science stories, though. Here's the News Jam.
News Jam.
The UK government has unveiled plans for an energy revolution that it hopes will reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 34% on 1990 levels within 11 years. It includes new plans for renewables, carbon budgets for government departments, and incentives for cleaner industry and transport. Critics, however, said the plans still fell short of the cuts scientists are demanding.
In an improbable marriage between old and new energy, geneticist Craig Venter has announced a deal with the oil giant ExxonMobil to develop biofuels from algae. The $600 million project will develop fuels that can be used in cars and aeroplanes without the need for any modification of their engines.
As the world faces the biggest flu pandemic on record, pharmaceutical labs have been racing to develop a vaccine for the H1N1 virus. There are several promising strains in the pipeline, but last week it became clear that sufficient stocks are unlikely to be available before the autumn.
And finally, four Russians, a German and a Frenchman emerged from a capsule in Moscow after 105 days of confinement. The experiment was designed to simulate the physiological and psychological stresses of an 18-month round trip to Mars, and the participants declared the task very easy. James, let's go into that energy white paper. It was one of the biggest government white papers produced in the last couple of years, I think, wasn't it? There's several studies all about how to take Britain from its sort of high carbon diet now to something where we're going to be environmentally friendly in 20 to 50 years. And it sort of covered everything from industry to transport to energy, everything really. Can you take us through a couple of the highlights?
This is the best attempt in the last few years to really grab hold of the climate change situation and kind of put together a comprehensive attack on it. The fundamental thing is switching our energy supply from high carbon to lower carbon. I mean, it won't be hugely lower by in 10 years' time, but it will be significantly lower. And they want to do that mainly through renewable technologies and principally wind. They also want to start bringing nuclear plants onto stream, which are obviously also low carbon. So that's kind of the headline there. But the other aspect of it, which not that many people sort of picked up on, is that this really is rowing back from the sort of liberalised energy market that was brought in by Thatcher. And it's saying, well, actually, no, we need government intervention in the energy market to not just have everything run on price, but also to have other incentives for low carbon energy.
Well, otherwise they wouldn't be commercially successful, because coal, oil, they've had so much, cheap, so long,
and gas, they're dead cheap. It's very cheap, yeah.
Exactly. So you're never going to get renewable technology like wind or even tidal and that kind of thing. I
mean, obviously already, you know, wind has, there are the renewable obligations certificates which promote renewable energy, but there's a real ramping up of that.
So all of the cuts, 40% of the cuts will come from changing our energy sector to this low carbon sources. Other ones, for example, the homes, people want, the government wants to insulate your home and make it more energy efficient. That's going to count for something like almost 30% of the planned cuts. Transport's an interesting one, because here's something where it's very hard to find a low carbon alternative quickly.
Yeah. I mean, there's a real push on electric cars here, which is important. The government have announced that earlier in the year, but you know, this sort of cements that. And on top of that, there's a kind of aspiration, a plan, which frankly the government should have done, 10 years ago. I don't know why it's taken them so long, but for high-speed rail links.
It's a very pragmatic report. It's trying to solve something in the immediate terms, but I would have liked to have seen some sort of forward-looking thought about some of the more, the sort of the biofuel debate or some of the new science technologies that might help to address some of this, because I mean, at the moment, I just don't know where that investment's going to come, and synthetic biology is a classic example of that in the UK at the moment, because there isn't a huge amount of investment. And, that has the promise to deliver, quite significant improvements in this area.
James, what was the reaction by green groups and environmental campaigners and so on, and in fact energy companies as well? Because there was quite a lot of stuff in this, and it was quite a bold position statement from Ed Miliband, the energy secretary. Did they respond well?
I think it was broadly positive, really. I mean, the green groups were, almost all of them were saying, yes, this is exactly what we need. Maybe, a few of them were saying, well, we need to be even more ambitious than this. But I think actually most of them were pretty satisfied that the government was doing as much as they had hoped would happen. In terms of the energy companies, they seem to be behind it too, because I think there's lots of cash coming their way for doing all sorts of new things. So they seem to be reasonably happy. I mean, the main people who don't seem to be in favour of it are those who, the two biggest arguments that were put up by other sort of segments of the press, if you like, are those who hate wind farms in all their forms, because this will entail more wind farms on land and especially offshore, but also there will be increases in price on bills to pay for this.
Energy bills will get higher, but the idea also is that your home's going to get more efficient, so you use less of it anyway. They said that it would be £200 a year more, but then because of all the efficiencies, it will only end up being something like £70 a year, which is actually, relatively speaking, not so much, I guess. The other thing, one thing I wanted to mention before we move on to the next subject is nuclear power. Nuclear power is going to come back to Britain in a fairly big way, and I think most scientists are and science-led people would think this is a good idea. The environmentalists don't like this at all. But I mean, I would question one thing, is that we haven't sorted out the waste issue. That's a vexed question. But is that waste worse than having carbon dioxide in the atmosphere? I mean, it's a question I think that a lot of people don't think about.
Well, it's contained, isn't it? I mean, the waste is contained. It's a lot of it, and it's going to be around for thousands of years. But at least it's contained. The carbon dioxide, not contained.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's move on to Craig Venter. So Craig Venter's working with ExxonMobil, one of the largest oil companies in the world, to look at producing biofuels from algae. Now, algae are going to be very useful, I think, as a way of producing all sorts of things, from pharmaceuticals to fuel. They can produce some of the strains that he's found in his trawl around the world can produce hydrocarbons, which are quite similar, not exactly the same, quite similar to the kinds of things that you put in your petrol tank. And the idea is that you would use the existing infrastructure to process and then to burn this stuff. And it's all carbon neutral, because these algae grow by taking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. And $600 million put into this project. Paul, is this where the money's going to come from for subjects like yours?
It's got that feeling, because BP also invested quite heavily in the US in Berkeley, and they put in, I think, $500 million, if I remember rightly, looking at biofuels, looking at all that sort of stuff. So it looks as if some of these large multinational energy companies are realizing that actually the future lies in biological solutions to the energy problem, or one aspect lies in biological solutions. And they're beginning to, really seriously invest, because it's a, there's going to be a huge gain if they can crack this and use it. The key here is to use in existing infrastructure. So, I mean, we don't want to be reinventing engines and gas stations. We want to use materials that can go into the existing system, be transported around and all the rest of it. And that's really important. And the really good thing about what Ventner and Jay Keesling and all these guys are doing is that they're thinking about that up front, rather than waiting to, have a scientific discovery and then thinking, well, how can we apply it? They're actually sort of almost working backwards, saying, this is the problem. How are we going to, solve that? Which is what synthetic biology does, actually.
Just going back to the point you made earlier on about the sort of lack of funding in the UK, public funding in particular, is there a danger here that if the funding for this sort of stuff comes from Shell and BP and the likes of that, that they will hold the IP and they will control the technology in the future? So, they will have a sort of stranglehold on the market, and it won't be a technology that will benefit everyone.
Let me just clarify. When I said there is investment in the UK, the EPSRC and have invested in our new centre, which is fantastic. What I meant by investment is not on the same scale as what.
I was sort of paraphrasing your position.
Because I think the government research councils are aware of synthetic biology and the opportunities, but clearly we're all in a bit of a tight squeeze at the moment in the UK, and it's going to get worse. So the public purse is going to get squeezed even more. So we're talking the investments that are needed to really create new industries, which is what this field could lead to, is really substantial. And you're absolutely right saying if it's going to be led by multinationals, we're going to end up in this horrible debate, which will the GM crop thing will rear its ugly head, and everyone will be saying, well, all the big multinationals are just making profit and controlling technology and all the rest of it. And we've got to avoid that. Absolutely. It's really important to avoid that completely. So one of the great drivers in synthetic biology is open source. One of the big things is that everything's open source, everything's shared, everything's out in the public domain. And, everyone in the field is acutely aware of the issues of big technology being caught up in IP and legal, frameworks that not allowing other people to use it.
But James, one question to you, actually. What's wrong with companies owning IP to things, really? Because if you think about it now, the energy infrastructure that we have is owned by Shell, BP, whoever, EDF Energy, and they make money out of it. That's why they do it, and we get cheap energy out of it. Is there really an issue if, for example, the Craig Venter develops some algae that ends up producing all of our biofuel? As long as we get it cheaply, is that an issue?
Possibly. I mean, possibly not. But the I guess the argument from some people would be we may not get it cheaply because he will be able to control the price because it's his IP. But the field that people always bring up with this is pharmaceuticals, that the way we develop drugs globally is massively flawed because it's controlled by a small number of companies that have all the money, and that means that the sorts of illnesses that actually get have cures made for them are the ones for the rich world that can afford to pay for them. So the ones that affect lots of people, like TB in Africa, that are just not as glamorous and don't have the money in terms of people who can afford to pay for them, don't get solved. So, I mean, maybe the situation is not quite analogous, but there are when you have a small number of companies controlling such an important industry, I mean, I think there are certainly questions worth asking.
But energy is just energy, isn't it? You can use energy anywhere. Anyway, another discussion. You can read all of this stuff on the website, of course, at guardian.co.uk/science and guardian.co.uk/environment.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jar.
Neil Armstrong reporting the roll and pitch program, which puts Apollo 11 on a proper heading.
40 years ago today, men landed on the moon. The story of Neil Armstrong, Eugene Buzz Aldrin and Michael Collins on Apollo 11 is familiar to everyone and, despite being told so many times, never gets less interesting. Now, we've spent the last 2 weeks lovingly retelling that story on the Guardian Science website, and so, on the actual anniversary today, we thought we'd look to the future. NASA plans to return to the moon and then go on to Mars within the next few decades under the Constellation programme. One of the men planning the missions is NASA's John Olsen. He normally looks after the International Space Station, but he's also designing the next crew exploration vehicles for future astronauts. Science Weekly's Andy Duckworth asked Olsen why there's a need for more space missions.
By having humans explore celestial bodies other than the planet Earth, it's almost like an inherent insurance policy. By having the ability to live on another planet, it also is about understanding the fossil record or the impact record or our past experience that we've had on Earth that oftentimes gets erased by our own environment with wind and water and waves, whereas without an environment or an atmosphere on the moon, it's a perfect recordation mechanism of all the things that have come into the near sphere of the Earth-Moon space. Likewise, as we talk about radio telescopes, perhaps on the back side of the moon, on the dark side of the moon, in that quiescent, shielded from the Earth's RF spectrum, it helps us to, perhaps with greater sensitivity, look for signs of life in other potential contexts out there.
the time scale of looking at something like this is so far in advance, isn't it? What are some of the problems with planning anything so far in advance?
You can't bring everything with you in terms of consumables. As we look at those type of environmental control and life support systems that are closed, meaning we reutilize everything, we're going to need to do that to have the sustained long-term presence on the moon. As we look to an outpost, many of those very elements are already the precursor building blocks for living beyond. Ultimately, you know, we currently have the International Space Station crews go for 180-day missions to the space station. So too are we looking to do the same thing on the surface of the moon at our outposts. So we're already pursuing that path and taking that journey. And as we go to Mars, with today's technologies, it's currently about a six-month trip to Mars, up to a year stay in order to do useful work, and then about a six-month journey back. So you're looking at a two-year mission, so you're already looking at a fairly significant portion of time for having human beings be off-planet. And that certainly presents some challenges, but I think as we've discovered water on the surface of Mars, in terms of all of human history, what an exciting time to explore and expand, and that should really energize a lot of folks.
What kind of time scale are we looking at for something like that, that mission to Mars, you know, two-year mission?
Well, you know, that's a tough question, because some of it depends certainly upon budgets, others on technologies, certainly on national and international will and commitment, because a mission of that nature, by the very scope of its challenge and complexity, is going to have to be international. No nation has enough treasure and resources to do it alone. And certainly the benefits to humanity also point towards having a broad partnership. But we notionally have looked at some timelines whereby if we have a human lunar return in 2020, we look at having an outpost in place around the 2024-ish timeframe. And then, depending upon the maturation of the technologies and the capabilities and funds, as we've already mentioned, perhaps maybe in the 2030, 2035 time frame, we could start looking for a human mission to Mars. And there are many who would say, you know, that's just not soon enough. We ought to go there sooner. But we've got to take an affordable and a prudent and a rational approach. And we also have to develop mitigations and countermeasures to those very tough, challenging problems of radiation countermeasures, psychology, closed-loop systems, planetary protection, both protecting the planet Mars as well as protecting the planet Earth. And so we will probably need to do Mars sample return missions prior to that to get those techniques and procedures down.
That was NASA's John Olson. You can hear the full extended version of that interview in Science Extra this week. It's in your podcast feed now. Or if you're not a subscriber to the programme, you can get it from guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. Also, do visit our Apollo 11 website, where you'll find videos, audio interviews and a whole bunch of articles celebrating and analysing the Apollo programme. That's at guardian.co.uk/Apollo 11. Just before we head out of the door, let's come back to Paul Fremont, synthetic biologist at Imperial College London. Paul, part of the future of this subject depends on your students, I'm assuming, because they're going to be the ones getting excited about this, yeah. Building new things. They're entering an interesting competition that you might want to tell us about.
Yeah. Every year there's a competition which is held at MIT in the United States, and it's a competition generally for undergraduate students, and it's called the International Genetically Engineered Machine Competition, or iGEM for short. And this year there's over 120 universities from all around the world, every continent represented pretty much, sending along teams of, say, 8 or 10 undergraduates, and they will be presenting the results of their summer project. So the students tend to start around July now, I guess early July, and they go through to September. And in that time, they've got to brainstorm, think of a synthetic biology project, some application, something, and actually then do some experiments and actually show whether it would work or not.
What are your students making?
Well, they've just finished 2 weeks of intense brainstorming, and we're at a very low point in the project at the moment because they're all a bit... No, it's a normal... we've been through this before. It's interesting, actually, because they end up spend a lot of time brainstorming. They come up with some great ideas, and of course, we've got to beat them all back down, bring them down to earth, you know, and sort of, you know, use our experience to say, well, look, you know, you're not going to be able to do that, or that's not possible in the time frame or in the context of the competition. But we've got some interesting ideas. I mean, one of the things we're working on, actually, which looks really interesting, is a self-encapsulating bacteria. So the idea here would be It's a great idea, actually, which is the idea of you actually manufacture a drug or a supplement, a vitamin supplement within the bacteria, and then you trigger a little genetic circuit which self-encapsulates it to make a pill and kills the bacteria at the same time. So you end up with this sort of, you know, micro pill, I suppose, which is a really neat idea.
What are some of the other experiments that go on there? What kinds? Are they useful or they're just exercises?
No, these are really creatively useful because actually some of them have led on to research projects, proper research projects. So in my lab, we've got a couple of PhD students who started off life as iGEM students and have carried on their research. And one of them is looking into making a biosensor detector that would detect infections on urinary catheters. Another one is looking at influencing bacillus bacteria and actually controlling where it moves and also allowing it to create new biomaterials in a very defined 3D manner. So these are proper research projects.
What won last year?
Project from Slovenia. Slovenia have won it actually a couple of times, and they send in, they have very good projects which are all based on human disease generally. And I think they were working on HIV last year, and they had some very neat idea about how you might be able to detect HIV, human cells, engineered human cells to detect HIV and sort of trigger some kind of response that would allow the HIV to be cleared. That was a little bit futuristic, actually. But I mean, most of the iGEM projects are meant to be futuristic. They're meant to be, you know, really exciting and innovative and interesting, and, you know, and that's part of the field, and that seeds the excitement, and a lot of that then does lead into, you know, proper research.
Well, we look forward to covering more of this stuff, obviously, in the future. That's it for this week's show, though. It remains for me now just to thank my guests, Paul Fremont and James Randerson. Science Weekly will be back next Monday. I'm Alok Jha, and thanks to James Kingsland for his help with the show today, which was produced by Scott Cawley. Thanks for listening.
Okay, engine stop. Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot.